Hi, my name is Leo Jean Peters. I'm a theater director and creator. I live in Wellington, and I'm originally from San Antonio, Texas, in the United States. I'm making a new theater show that deals with the questions about climate change. Over the past few years, I keep hearing more and more about this issue in the media. Films like The Day After Tomorrow gloss over the science in a heroic way, but they don't illuminate much of the issue. Even after spending hours online, I still know very little, and I'm not sure what I can trust and what's fabricated. I believe the theater is a place where we ask difficult questions of ourselves and our world. In our consumer-driven society, we don't have a place to reflect together, to meet. We lack the rituals that guide us in a communal way through the big changes and the big questions of our lives. Climate change definitely appears to be one of these big questions. But before we deal with the current issues, it seems crucial to understand how the climate developed, how it created life, and how it keeps working to sustain life. Let's chat with some scientists to get a better sense of the beginning.
My name is James Crampton, and I'm a paleontologist, work on fossils and their applications to many branches of geology. And part of that is I'm involved with a large team of people working on paleoclimate, or ancient climates of the planet, and how they relate to future climate.
How old is the Earth?
The Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, or that's 4,500 million years.
4,500 million years old.
Yes, yes. Geological time is one of those concepts that's really hard to understand. And I guess geologists get used to using these numbers, but I'm not even sure that they really understand the enormity of time. One can make an analogy, a simple little analogy, to try and convey just how enormous that time is. Let's say, for sake of argument, that you were going to walk from Wellington to Auckland. And if that distance, which is about 660 kilometres, if that represented the whole life of the Earth, 4.5 billion years, and then you can mark key milestones on the way. So, for example, the first life. You leave Wellington, you're going to walk to the Sky Tower in Auckland. And you're walking along, and the first life appeared on the planet about 4 billion years ago. And that's about 100 kilometres from Wellington, or, if you like, just north of Levin. So that's the first life, and this is simple, single-celled little bacteria. So the first complex life, what we would think of fossils, so things that look like worms or things with shells, little mollusks, little clams and little things, little crab-like things, those things appeared actually 550 million years ago. But on your walk from Wellington to Auckland, that's about 580 kilometres on your way. So that's Hamilton. So if you're walking from Wellington to Auckland, the first things that we'd recognise as fossils don't appear until you hit Hamilton. The first land animals and plants are at about 600 kilometres, so that's close to Narrawa here. And then the interesting thing is hominids, or these are the ancestors of human beings, they first appeared about 5 million years ago, and that's when you're just 700 metres from the Sky Tower. So the history of human ancestors really only starts 700 metres from the Sky Tower. And Homo sapiens, that's our species, and, say, the controlled use of fire, so then what we think about as humans proper, that's 30 paces from the door of the Sky Tower. So you've walked all the way from Wellington, you get to 30 paces from the Sky Tower, and that's where you first meet humans, Homo sapiens.
We're looking at huge timescales that the Earth has existed without humanity.
Exactly. I mean, it makes you realise humans are just the last pace on the way. They're just a nothing. In the history of the planet, humans are just a little blip at the end. And that's just to try and convey the enormity of time we're dealing with.
Can you give us a sense of how these life forms sort of first developed, or what that was like?
That's still not clearly understood. I mean, the evolution of life, there's a lot of things we don't understand, but there's certain things we can say. The first thing is that life is not an inevitable consequence of planet formation. And we just need to look at the other planets, and most of them, as far as we know, have no life at all. To get life, you have to have certain key ingredients. And this includes things like the planet has to be about the right distance from the sun. Strangely, the planet has to have a molten interior. And this seems surprising, but that confers several benefits on a planet, or for life benefits. It gives you continental drift, which is really important because it's continental drift that recycles nutrients from the crust into the environment for animals and plants to use. Having a molten interior of the planet gives us our magnetic field, which is crucial for shielding us from harmful rays from the sun. And having a molten interior gives us volcanoes. And again, volcanoes are essential for generating the atmosphere. And there's a third thing that the planet really has to have to generate life, we think, and that is something like a moon, because that actually stabilizes the orbit and the rotation of the planet. It acts like a sort of stabilizer, like a stabilizer on a kid's bicycle. That keeps the environment more constant than it would be otherwise. So life is not an inevitable consequence of planet formation, but if you've got these key ingredients, then it seems like that life probably did and would evolve simply as part of the planetary development. Now, there's a really important concept here, is that life is not separate or different from the evolving planet. They're inextricably linked. The two things have developed, have evolved together. They're not separate entities. But after its first development, life then becomes a planetary process and a force in its own right. And it's not separate from the whole, all the other things developing, the physical things developing on the planet. There's a lovely overseas researcher described life, after all, as just a bag of chemistry. Life is just chemistry, and everything else on this planet is really just chemistry, whether it's the atmosphere or the rocks or whatever. And life is just another form of chemistry that's interacting with everything else on the planet.
Essentially, you're saying that the atmosphere and the life that it supports, they sort of co-developed.
That's exactly right. We think the first atmosphere on the planet was basically helium and hydrogen, and that couldn't sustain life as we know it now, of course. But these are very light gases, and they were basically lost to space. They were followed by an atmosphere made mainly of methane, or natural gas, mm-hmm. ammonia, hydrogen, and water vapor. Now, again, this doesn't sound very tasty to animals today. But all these gases came out of volcanoes, and that early water vapor then condensed to form the early oceans. The point is, there was no oxygen.
So where did the oxygen come from?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, today we have the atmosphere's got 21% oxygen in it. And obviously, this is what sustains all the life as we know it now. Now, the key thing, today's atmosphere is not a stable atmosphere. It's not the natural dead planet atmosphere. Basically, it was due largely, or perhaps entirely, due to life. And the oxygen came initially from bacteria, little what we call photosynthetic bacteria. These are just like plants. They take in sunlight and carbon dioxide, and they produce oxygen. And it's thought that all the oxygen in the atmosphere has been generated by the very early bacteria that developed on the planet. And there's a couple of ironies in here. Firstly, oxygen is effectively a waste product. What we live on now is a waste product of these early bacteria. And the other irony is actually that oxygen was probably toxic to those early bacteria. So they produced this oxygen that was toxic to themselves, and it was just their waste product. And so all the oxygen we see in the atmosphere today was generated by in that way. And obviously that fundamentally changed the whole atmosphere of this planet. And once the oxygen had reached, maybe 1% in the atmosphere, that was enough to allow larger, more complex animals to start to develop.
All of this waste product, then, it needs to be consumed, and that's where the larger animals come from?
Well, larger animals, just simply to function as an animal, you need a certain amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. And obviously, the early large animals were incredibly simple things. They didn't breathe like we do. The oxygen probably just diffused in through their skin, and there had to be a certain amount of it around for them to even start to grow larger animals. And that happened sort of 600 million years ago or something like that. So for 2 billion years, the whole Earth ecosystem was just dominated by single-celled algae, basically.
So but over the time... For 2 billion years?
2 billion years. It's interesting. Andrew Knoll, who's a famous North American paleontologist, describes the planet basically as a bacterial planet. He says, and I think he's right in this, that bacteria are essential for the functioning of planet ecosystems. In fact, the sad thing for us is humans and plants and cows and sheep and lettuces aren't actually essential. The thing that are essential are bacteria. We're just an optional extra, really.
An add-on to the bacterial planet.
Exactly. There's another nice way of describing this, the development of oxygen. James Lovelock, the a famous British scientist who developed the Gaia hypothesis, he described the increase of oxygen in the atmosphere as the planetary adolescence, which is quite a nice way of describing it. It was a fairly traumatic and dramatic change in the lifespan of the planet.
Like a going through puberty.
Going through puberty, exactly.
So what is the Gaia? You said the Gaia theory?
Basically, it states that all of life on the planet is inextricably linked to the atmosphere and to the physical crust of the planet, if you like, that you cannot view life forms independently of the atmosphere they live in and of the rocks and the oceans that they live in as well, and that the whole thing is an integrated whole. Now, there's a slightly muted version of Gaia, which is widely accepted now, that's called Earth System Science, and that basically states that everything is intimately interrelated, and this is not controversial anymore. Gaia takes that one step further and suggests that actually this what we see is this environment now, including the crust, the animals living on that crust, the oceans and the air, is all one unit. Gaia would state that actually developed in a sort of self-organizing way to sustain life as we know it. And in fact, Gaia says that the planet left it, if there wasn't any life on the planet now, naturally, in its natural state, the planet should be dead. The sun is too hot. We should be a dead planet. But life works with the planet to maintain a planet that's habitable for life.
So in a sense, the organisms living on the planet, in a way, are like the organs of a body, or there's some parts of the body in those.
That's
terms.
Exactly how Lovelock and his colleagues see it. And they actually talk about geophysiology, and in other words, a planet-scale physiology that's an integrated whole. Now, as I say, many scientists don't accept the idea that the system actively maintains the Earth in a habitable state. But most scientists now accept this idea of what they call Earth system science, which at least recognises that everything is incredibly tightly interrelated. And there's all sorts of complex feedbacks, which we're really, really only just starting to understand. An example would be the algae in the ocean produce a thing called dimethyl sulfide, which is a key component in seeding clouds over the ocean. And it's essential for seeding clouds over the ocean. The high clouds above the oceans actually reflect sunlight back, so they cool it. Now, algae in the ocean require ocean to be... The slightly cooler the ocean is, the better the algae grow. If the ocean gets too hot, the algae disappear. So the algae release dimethyl sulfide, which goes into the atmosphere, seeds clouds. The clouds reflect sunlight, which helps keep the whole thing cool. Now, that is one of these sort of mechanisms that James Lovelock would see as one of Gaia's tools for maintaining the whole planet in a habitable state.
It's amazingly sort of interconnected, though, regardless of whether it's one organism or whether it's not. It's accepted that it's a huge system.
A huge, complex system. And you've got the same sort of mechanisms to do with nutrient cycling, you know, iron and phosphorus and carbon and nitrogen, all have incredibly complex interrelationships. The Amazon jungle, for example, really shouldn't be growing where it is. It should be dry there. The trees and the jungle creates its own cloud mass that creates the daily rainfall in the Amazon jungle that keeps the whole thing wet enough to keep the trees there. Now, if you interrupt that system, the trees won't just grow back, because once they've gone, they won't seed the clouds that keep the rainfall high, that keep it wet enough to have a jungle. There's feedbacks. There's 1,001 feedbacks like this, most of which we don't understand yet.
That gives us a sense of the whole. Let's zoom in and try to get a better understanding about the development of biological life.
My name's David Wharton. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Zoology at Otago University.
What exactly is life? How would we recognize life if we were looking for it?
Well, I guess most people have an intuitive feel for what is living or what is not living. But sort of more formally, biologists have used various definitions, and that the definition used has changed with time as we understand more about living systems. So I guess sort of people's main feeling would be that living things do things like grow and move and excrete and reproduce and move, respond to stimuli. The problem is that sort of a definition sometimes excludes things which we know are alive and yet do not fit that definition. For example, there are a number of simple organisms that can go into an ametabolic state called cryptobiosis, where all their metabolism ceases, and all those things that we think of as being characteristic of a living thing, they stop doing. So they don't move anymore, and they don't grow, and they don't age, and they don't reproduce. And yet, if you pop them back into water, they usually go into this state as a result of a stress such as desiccation. Put them back into water, and within a couple of hours, they're happily moving around again. So they're obviously not dead.
What is desiccation, David?
Drying out, yeah.
Oh, sure. So they dry out, and then you put them back into water, and they come back to life.
Yes. Well, if they've died, I mean, we tend to think of there being two states of living things. They're either alive or they're dead. Mm. Well, it appears these things are capable of a third state, cryptobiosis, which means literally hidden life, where the capacity for life is there, but it's not actually apparent until the conditions are right for that organism. So that's led on to other definitions. People have defined life with respect to the second law of thermodynamics, which of course states that the amount of disorder or entropy in the universe is always increasing. And life seems to move against that because living organisms are putting together order out of apparent disorder. However, we must realise that these living things are not a closed system. They're actually taking energy from outside their bodies, notably in the form of sunlight, and so they're maintaining their order at the expense of an overall increase in disorder or entropy. So disorder in the universe is always increasing. The sun is burning fuel, and so it's over millions of years and millions and millions of years, it's gradually running down and decreasing that fuel source. So entropy is disorder. So life seems to be against that. Probably the most favoured definition now, most biologists favour a definition which includes an evolutionary and a genetic or informational component. Mm. So living things have instructions for their structure and functioning within their genes, and of course that consists of the nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. So a recent definition of life which is frequently quoted was proposed by Gerald Joyce from the Scripps Research Institute in San Diego, who said that life is a self-sustaining chemical system capable of undergoing Darwinian evolution. So it has that informational content which is then passed on to the next generation.
So we're born, in a way, for life to exist, we have to know sort of innately how to live.
Well, we have to have the blueprint. And that blueprint, great. Of course, is contained within our genes.
Mm. When did life develop?
Well, now, we need to talk about the last 4 billion years now. So.
Opening up the focus a little bit.
Well, the planet Earth was thought to have formed 4.6 billion years ago. And during its early stages, of course, conditions would have been too severe for life to have formed. So it would have taken several 100 million years for the surface of the Earth to cool sufficiently, first of all to form a crust, the actual rocks on the surface, and then the atmosphere and the oceans. So it's thought the earliest life actually appeared about 4 billion years ago, presumably self-assembled from simpler molecules.
And when did this life develop into more complex forms?
Well, it depends what you mean by more complex. I suppose even the simplest cell is incredibly more complex than simple chemicals. So even a simple organism is relatively complex. But cells that we'd actually recognise as being living organisms, they probably developed relatively early on. In fact, it's thought the oldest fossils that we have evidence for any life, which are fossilised bacteria. There's good evidence for fossilised bacteria that are 3.8 billion years old and reasonable evidence for slightly older than that, say 3.86 billion years. And they'd resemble bacteria that we see today. But animal life would have come along much later, in fact. So right, probably for at least half the age of the Earth, perhaps even three quarters of the age of the Earth, life consisted of single-celled organisms, only more complex multicellular life, plants and animals and fungi and the like, came along much later on.
When did these early plants and fungi develop?
Okay, well, they're all multicellular organisms, and they're thought to have come along about a billion years ago, 1,000 million years ago. Mm-hmm. But the animals didn't really appear in the fossil record until what's called the Cambrian explosion, where there seemed to be, or at least the appearance in the fossil record seemed to happen relatively suddenly, so that's why it's called the Cambrian explosion. That's associated with the development of a whole series of different phyla of animals. Now, a different phylum means a different body plan. So we have a body plan of having a backbone and bilateral symmetry. Other animal phyla have different body plans, might have two layers of cells or three layers of cells in the body cavity, etc. Well, during the Cambrian explosion in the fossil record, we can recognise up to about 100 of those different major body plans or phyla, of which about 35 of those phyla are still around today.
How unusual an event was this explosion?
Well, that's probably fairly unique. I can't think of another example in the fossil record where there'd be such the appearance of so many groups of animals spontaneously, apart from where there have been major extinction events and then recolonization of the Earth by new species following on that extinction event.
Is it possible for there to be life on other planets? Like, I'm thinking Venus and Mars, they're our nearest neighbors. Could life develop there, or has it developed there in this way?
Well, it's possible, but I can't tell you for certain because I haven't been to those planets, and in fact,
sure,
no one has.
Enough.
The only other body in the universe that humans have been to is, of course, our moon, and that turned out to be a rather barren place as far as life is concerned. So all we can do is to look at other places in the universe, such as Venus and Mars, and see what sort of conditions are like there, and then compare them with conditions on Earth and see if conditions are similar. Turns out that Venus is actually rather a hostile place. Its surface temperature is around about 450 degrees centigrade. And the reason for that is that it's covered in a thick atmosphere, and that acts, you'll have heard of the greenhouse effect. Well, Venus is said to have a runaway greenhouse effect, which has caused those surface temperatures to elevate to those high levels. And although there are organisms on Earth that will survive temperatures over 100 degrees centigrade, there are none that will survive temperatures as high as 450 degrees centigrade. So it seems highly likely that Venus is not a suitable place for life to develop. Mars, on the other hand, does look a bit more promising, although in its current state, it's way too cold. The average surface temperature on Mars is around about minus 50 degrees centigrade, although it's thought that temperatures may get just above 0 degrees centigrade on the Martian equator. However, there does seem to be a lot of evidence that further back in Martian history, the planet was warmer, and there was the possibility that there was liquid water present on the surface of Mars. And we see a lot of evidence today that there has been water on Mars at some time in its history.
Is water a necessary component for the origination of life?
I think a lot of scientists or astrobiologists, people who think about life in the universe, think that that's the essential feature for life, that life can only exist in the presence of liquid water. And liquid water is likely to be in rather short supply in the universe. If we think about the range of temperatures in the universe, they vary from those from temperatures at the centre of stars, which are 15 million degrees centigrade, so a little bit too hot, to in deep space, where temperatures are close to absolute zero, which is minus 273 degrees centigrade. Pure water is a liquid only over a range of 100 degrees centigrade, from 0 degrees centigrade to 100 degrees centigrade, of course. So that's a small fraction of the range of temperatures that are likely to be experienced in the universe. Now, it's important that water is a liquid for life because it provides a medium in which the metabolic reactions upon which life depends can occur. If the water was frozen, there would not be enough mobility for those reactions to occur. And, of course, if it's present in a steam, a similar thing applies. So many people equate the presence of liquid water with the presence of life, and that's certainly true on Earth.
I'm kind of mystified by all the circumstances that have to come together in the beginning of life. Whether you choose to view it as the work of an omnipotent creator or as simply a series of happy accidents, it's a pretty amazing event. Throughout this research, I've frequently come across the term the Goldilocks zone, the need for a climate that's just right, like the baby bear's porridge in the children's story. With David, we've seen what a runaway greenhouse can do on Venus, and we hear a lot about greenhouse gases today. So what does this mean for our present civilization in the context of the Goldilocks zone? Dr. Tim Naish will tell us a little bit about the Goldilocks zone and why it exists.
I'm a paleoclimatologist. I specialize in Antarctic climate and how Antarctica drives the Earth's climate system. I work for the GNS Science, and I also spend half of my time as Deputy Director of the Antarctic Research Centre of Victoria University.
What is the Goldilocks zone?
Well, it's not too cold and it's not too hot, it's just right.
And what does that mean in terms of climate? Can you explain that a bit further?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess in terms of climate and the evolution of species, in particular our own species, the Goldilocks zone has been that time where the conditions of our planet have just been right for our species to flourish and for our civilization to really flourish. So from a geological perspective, we think of the Goldilocks zone as the last 10,000 years. So this is a time when sea level's been roughly at the present sea level and Earth's temperature has been roughly 14 degrees C on average, and things have been just right for life.
Why has the climate been so stable over the last 10,000 years?
Yeah, interesting question, that one. It's not one that's particularly easy to answer. If you look at the natural cycles that have taken us in and out of ice ages, cold periods when there's been lots of ice on the poles, and then back into warm periods, the actual warm periods, such as the Goldilocks zone we're in right now, tend to be rather short-lived. Mm. So I guess what I'm saying is that the present period in which our species has really flourished and our civilizations have developed, it has not been common if you look back several million years. However, there are a few times where we do see these long, stable, warm periods. And we think there is a mechanism controlling that.
What does it do?
Well, you could sort of think of it as a solar clock, if you like, that's tick-tocked over long time scales in a very regular way. So it's all tied up with our orbit around the sun, and our orbit has not been constant around the sun. So over long time scales, the Earth or parts of the surface of the Earth have either been closer or further away because of long-term changes in the Earth's orbit. And of course, that variation in distance from the sun controls the amount of heat received by the surface of the Earth, and therefore controls whether we're going to be in an ice age or in a warm period.
We could think of the Earth's orbit as a rubber band, maybe? Like the Earth is kind of stretched at points around further away from the sun and it comes back closer. Would that be somewhat accurate?
That's not a bad comparison, actually. And I think maybe you think of the other planets in the solar system as also being connected by rubber bands, if you like, and they all exert influence on each other.
Yeah.
So when one changes, they all change. Now,
that's gravity?
That's gravity, essentially. Yeah. So your rubber band is the gravitational attraction between the bodies or the planets in our solar system. The solar system and its movement is actually chaotic over long timescales, and that's very long timescales, but we can mathematically model the orbits and the Earth's orbit, And we see it as being what we call quasi-periodic. So we see actually periodic changes in the Earth's orbit that have been regular, like clockwork, through time, through long geological time, over millions of years.
There are different climates all over the Earth. Like, we have different climates in the poles than we do in the equator. So why, if we're just being pulled back and forth, why isn't it the same climate all the way around?
Yeah, I mean, this is the essence of the solar clock and the change in the Earth's orbits, and what that does, these variations in the Earth's orbit affect what we call the seasonal distribution of insulation. Okay,
so seasonal distribution of insulation.
I know, jargon. But what I'm really talking about is the distribution of heat from the sun.
Sure.
Across the planet, it's not constant. We know that. That's why we have. You know, the seasons. We have, you know, winter and summer, and they're opposed depending on which hemisphere you're in. Over long time periods, the seasonal distribution of heat changes. And, okay, let me give you the first cycle. The first cycle is what we call eccentricity. And, again, another jargony word. It's 100,000 years in duration. And what it is the rubber band being stretched, if you like, as the Earth orbits the sun. The Earth's orbit is not circular, right? And over a 100,000-year cycle, it goes from being circular to being more...
elliptical?
Yeah, more elliptical.
Yeah.
And then it comes back to being more circular. So when it's in its elliptical phase, it's further away from the sun, and therefore our climate is cooler.
So that's sort of every 100 years it's in that... Like,
every 100,000 years.
Every 100,000 years.
Yeah.
Every 100,000 years.
Long time. It's over long time scales. But, interestingly enough, when we look back in the geologic record, if we drill holes in the ocean floor and we look at the layers, we can see that the Earth has had ice ages every 100,000 years.
That's because it's being stretched to the edges of the elliptical orbit, kind of, and furthest away from the sun?
Well, that's one of the theories, is that even although the actual shape of the orbit changes infinitesimally, really, but it's enough to affect the amount of heat coming in. And that smaller change in heat causes a whole set of runaway feedbacks that take us from a warm period we're in now to an ice age. And for the last million years, our climate has been dominated by this 100,000-year cycle. It's not as simple as just the solar clock having an effect, but the solar clock seems to kick off a series of events that then get, if you like, amplified through Earth's climate to drive us into an ice age.
So what's an example of this? Like, what might happen?
Well, there's a very famous oceanographer. His name's Wally Broker, and he has a theory, and people tend to listen to Wally because he's said some good things, and he's written some good books. Wally's theory on the ice ages goes a little bit like this, and this is sort of a sequence of events you might expect heading from a warm period we're now into the next ice age. So first of all, the orbital clock kicks in, and we go into an orbit that is colder. So we go into a phase of the orbit where the rubber band's stretched, we're further away
from the sun,
and it's cooler.
Cool.
Okay, that's actually only a real little change in terms of the amount of heat hitting the poles. But it's enough cooling at the poles to steepen what we call the thermal gradient, the difference between the equator and the pole of the southern hemisphere, to cause the winds to increase in intensity. That's how our westerly wind belt works. We have to have a difference in temperature between the pole and the equator. So we steepen that gradient, the westerly winds spin up. So what happens when the westerly winds spin up? Nutrients get blown around, such as iron-rich dust, and they essentially fertilize the ocean. We fertilize the ocean, what happens? Well, we kick off this thing called the biological pump. What is that? That's algal blooms. Okay? So more nutrients. The algae flourish in the ocean. They're gobbling up the iron-rich dust, but there's photosynthesizing. Mm. That's what trees do. They take in CO2 and they give off oxygen. So all of a sudden, the algal bloom in the ocean is gobbling up CO2 and drawing down a key greenhouse gas out of the atmosphere and cooling the atmosphere. Now, we call that a positive feedback. That's the ocean biological pump feedback. Then the next feedback is, okay, so you're cooling the southern hemisphere, you're cooling the atmosphere, sea ice expands around Antarctica. And that puts a lot of white on the planet. It doubles the white around Antarctica. And then we get another feedback called an ice albedo feedback, which is putting all that white on the Southern Ocean, which was black, reflects the sun, reflects the heat. So there's another feedback which cools because you're now reflecting the heat coming in. And then with that continued cooling, you get a large ice sheet developing, and then the Northern Hemisphere follows suit with a large ice sheet over the Northern Hemisphere, and you've gone from initially a very small stretching of the rubber band, or the distance between the sun and the Earth, a very small change in heat difference to a major change in climate on the planet in a full ice age.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the ice, so of course, and then as the ice age continues, more and more ice builds up, reflecting more and more heat?
Exactly.
And that prolongs the ice age in a way?
And essentially you go through a tipping point into a whole different set of boundary conditions, into an ice age world. And so you have a period of potentially quite stable climate in the ice age world until another butterfly flaps its wings, if you like, or a very small change sets in play a bunch of feedbacks within the system that take us then out again. And usually it's the solar clock that we think kicks the process off.
We have a sense of these huge gravitational forces working together and how these movements affect the temperature. The picture does get a bit more complicated. There are different cycles that are the results of different forces. The Earth is spinning on an angle that changes, and those changes affect the temperature as well. There are 20,000-year cycles, 40,000-year cycles, 100,000-year cycles. I still feel overwhelmed by the amounts of time we're dealing with, and I'm not quite sure about all the details. But we know the orbit of the Earth is another important aspect of this very sophisticated and intricate system. Let's talk with Tim about the atmosphere, what makes it work, and why the surface of the Earth is so much different than our neighboring planets.
Well, the atmosphere is this wonderful insulating blanket that allows us to flourish, really, survive. What is it? Well, I guess the bit of the atmosphere that is really important to us is the troposphere. So the troposphere is the lower 12 kilometers of the atmosphere. It's made up of largely nitrogen and oxygen, 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and then the final 1% are these trace gases. Now, I mean, that oxygen and nitrogen is obviously very important to us and to all the creatures, so we can live and breathe. But the atmosphere plays another role as well. It regulates the temperature of the Earth.
How does it do that?
Well, this is where that 1% of the trace gases become very important. Doesn't sound like much, but 1/20th of that 1% are the greenhouse gases.
1/20th of 1% of the atmosphere.
These are these very important greenhouse gases we hear about, which produce the greenhouse effect. So these are the gases like methane, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, chlorofluorocarbons. But the big one to us, the most significant gas volumetrically and in terms of its residence time in the atmosphere, the most significant ones are CO2, carbon dioxide, and methane. And what do they do? How do they work? Well, they have very important properties in terms of trapping reflected heat from the sun hitting the Earth. So the heat that the Earth receives from the sun is ultraviolet radiation, but once it's hit the Earth and is reflected, infrared has a longer wavelength. Now, heat of that wavelength gets essentially, if you like, trapped or interacts with the greenhouse gas molecules, and it doesn't escape the atmosphere. It stays in the greenhouse. So these gases are like a greenhouse, you know, where you've got the sun's energy coming in but being trapped inside the greenhouse by the glass, but in the case of our atmosphere, by the greenhouse gases.
By the greenhouse gases. So essentially the infrared heat comes in and it would bounce off and dissipate into the out of our atmosphere and off into space if it wasn't for these gases.
Well, to be technical, it comes in as ultraviolet and it goes off as infrared. Sure. And the infrared heat is the heat that gets trapped.
Which?
And, you know, it gives us, regulates our atmosphere, gives us that temperature that puts us in the Goldilocks zone.
So what is the lifespan of these gases? Of these greenhouse gases, this 1/20th of 1% of our atmosphere.
Right. Okay, that's an important question. and it really defines the importance of the gases themselves. So some of them are more short-lived. Methane, for example, is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas, but only lasts about 10 years. We call it a residence time. It's sort of an average time in the atmosphere. Mm. The CO2 is a significant gas because it can hang around for hundreds of years. So once you put CO2, like burning of fossil fuels, in the atmosphere, it's there. You commit yourself to some long-term effects.
Mm.
And what else have we got? The nitrous oxide's another important gas, and it's around about 100 years as well. But CO2 is the one we really do worry about in the context of global warming because we produce a lot of it from the burning of fossil fuels. It's a major contributor. And, you know, I talked about that 1/20th of 1%, you know, just being just right for the Goldilocks zone. Well, as we're changing that ratio significantly at the moment as a consequence of the industrial age and the burning of our fossil fuels.
While growing up, I often heard of the greenhouse effect and the greenhouse gases that heat our environment. I always heard of global warming, the dangerous increase in the Earth's temperature. But it's amazing to see the way these greenhouse gases fit into the picture and make life possible. By understanding and appreciating the delicate mix, this 1/20th of 1%, I begin to understand how subtle the balance is and how our waste disrupts that balance. That gives us a good picture of the atmosphere. How do the land and the ocean work into this complex system? Here's Peter Barrett, director of the Antarctic Research Center and director of the Joint Antarctic Research Institute.
Gondwana was a supercontinent, and it encompassed the present continents of Antarctica, South America, Africa, Australia, and India. New Zealand was still mud off the coast of Gondwana at that time. So that was like, it was that way for, well, several hundred million years. And the climate of the continent was pretty nice. It had forests and swamps and trees. And of course, amphibians and reptiles, because mammals hadn't arrived by then. But around about 180 million years ago, there was a quite extensive fracturing that produced lots of lavas and magma that came out, and continents started to separate. It was really part of the big rift that formed the Atlantic, and then that moved away from Antarctica, and South America moved north. And Australia at that time was still quite closely connected to Antarctica, but round about 40 million years ago, that started to move away as well. And so in the last 40 million years, the continents have become even more separated, and now Antarctica is isolated and surrounded by ocean. And that's had a profound effect on its climate.
What are some of the effects from the isolation?
The most obvious effect in the geography has been for Antarctica to be surrounded by ocean. When this was first being realized, this history, if you like, of plate tectonics, the first thought was, well, this separation really must have had something profound to do with Antarctic climate. And the big gateways that opened up around Antarctica around about 30 million years ago are about the same time as when the first ice sheets developed. And so it was theorized that the ocean circulation had changed, that when there was no oceans around Antarctica, it was the circulation was a Pacific Atlantic one with the waters circulating heat from the tropics down, sort of equalizing the Earth's temperature, and things are pretty equable. But once that breakage occurred, and once Antarctica was surrounded by ocean, this isolated the Antarctic thermally. And so that was a reason why people thought it became cold. Now, we actually know that that was also about the time when carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere dropped. And like they were 3 or 4 times pre-industrial levels back in dinosaur times. And they actually stayed pretty high until the time of the breakup. Now, we don't know if they're causally related. We just simply observe. But the modelling now indicates that there are two reasons why Antarctica has an ice sheet. A little bit of the thermal isolation, maybe 20%, but mostly that drop in CO2. It really started around about 35 million years ago, but it was down to present levels around 25 million years, and that's how it's been ever since.
Let's chat with Lionel Carter, who's a professor at the Antarctic Research Center and emeritus scientist at the National Institute of Water and Atmosphere, to get a better sense of how these currents affect the climate. So, Lionel, what is the Antarctic Circumpolar Current?
It's one of the big features on the planet. It happens to be the world's longest current at 27,000 kilometres length. It's the only current that joins the major oceans, running from the Pacific, the Atlantic and the Indian Oceans. It runs from west to east and does a clockwise journey around Antarctica. It carries an enormous amount of water.
So it basically circles...
It circles the Antarctic continent, if you like. It carries an enormous amount of water, roughly 100 times the amount of river water entering the world's oceans. So it is a big feature. Mm.
How does the current work? Why does it flow?
The current flows for a number of reasons. A, there's a pathway there, so there's got to be connection between the oceans. And the other is basically responding to the mid-latitude winds. Now, if you live in Wellington, you know what a westerly is.
Sure.
Anywhere on the west coast of New Zealand, westerlies, you feel the full force of those. And so basically, it's the westerlies driving that current. So the current flows, as I said, from west to east under the strongly forced by these mid-latitude wind belts. Yeah.
What does it do to the rest of the world's oceans?
The current has an unusual effect. In a sense, it helps isolate Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons why Antarctica is cold. And, of course, in that context, a cold Antarctica, as we will see, has tremendous influence on the world ocean. It produces a lot of the very cold, dense water which circulates throughout the planet. We can see plankton, which grew in Antarctica. And when we look in the deep water, that plankton's found off Connecticut.
Wow.
That's the power of Antarctica.
So why is this cold water important?
In essence, that cold water it forms in Antarctica. It's super cold. We have a program on the Ross Ice Shelf, and we've been looking at that cold water, and it's about minus 2 degrees. It's below freezing point simply because it's salty, and that just depresses the freezing point of any saline water. As we get out a little bit offshore, we get into the sea ice, and the sea ice has an unusual property, is that when winter comes and the ice forms, salt is expelled from the sea ice. They have yet to invent a salty ice cube.
Mm.
It just doesn't work. So the salt is expelled from the sea ice, and so we have this beautiful combination, super cold water meeting this brine, and that this heady combination of coldness and salt increases the density of that Antarctic water, and basically it sinks. And as it sinks, it starts to permeate throughout the world's oceans, under basically its own density. That's the reason they call it a thermohaline current, thermo heat, haline salt. So heat and salt are the big drivers in the deep ocean.
This cold, salty water sinks and moves out. What happens when it meets warmer water?
That's a good question. And that's that's one of the one of the great scientific investigations. In part, this cold, salty current flows past New Zealand. In fact, the current is at its largest as it passes up the eastern margin of New Zealand and into the Pacific. There, we believe the current, the salty cold water, diffuses or upwells both these processes. It slowly rises to the surface through various mechanisms, and one of them may be upwelling. And then certainly, as one would expect, as it's rising, it's starting to warm. Mm-hmm. And when it gets to the surface ocean, of course, it's warmed a little more. It's reaching those tropical warm waters. It's mixing. And so it's becoming a warm surface current. So from very deep cold, this process of upwelling and a diffusion brings it to the surface in the Pacific, where simply solar energy warms it.
And then so what happens to the warmer water?
The warmer water, we believe, returns in a return flow at the ocean surface. The warm, salty water in the Pacific moves through Indonesia, through the Indian Ocean, and then into the Atlantic, where it moves north as the Gulf Stream.
So it's a big conveyor belt then, isn't
it? It's a big conveyor belt in the cartoon sense, but really the conveyor belt is essentially a systems of loosely connected currents.
Hmm.
When the Atlantic sneezes, there's an effect felt off New Zealand for sure. But really it's a system of loosely connected currents, not something that's really tight.
How does the system of currents affect the climate?
Well, if you do some sums for Europe, if we didn't have that circulation in Europe of the Gulf Stream and its extensions towards Europe, Europe would be 10 degrees colder than it is now,
so
in round figures. It brings heat to Europe. It's carrying enough heat generated by a million Huntly power stations. That's the size of the amount of warmth that the Gulf Stream brings to that part of the world.
How does a stream carry heat?
The stream carries heat. Basically, the water is extremely warm. I was looking at the sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico during Katrina, and the temperature was 30-odd degrees centigrade at the ocean surface, a tremendous amount of heat. And that essentially is carried towards Europe. It passes into the atmosphere, it warms the atmosphere, and it warms Europe.
Climatic conditions during the last 10,000 years have been good for human civilization. But we see from a geological perspective how that balance is delicate, and we must ask how human interference, which has reached the level of a geological force, is affecting that balance. To make this theater show, and to ask these huge questions about the climate, I need to shift my perspective of the world. How do we comprehend and relate to the millions of years it has taken for life to develop? How do I relate to the millions of years that predate our species? There is a strong sense of connectedness between the systems of feedback that we see in our climate. Humanity is a part of this global system. So, of course, we should look at our waste products and what it does to the environment. But also, we should allow it to teach us about our fundamental identity and how we think of ourselves in the world.